Or the Laugh or Cry.
Blog Talk Radio.
Here we go.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it. Well, I and on the air.
Well, the sun is shining. It's fantastic outside. This is MJ Network, and this is Fran Lewis, and I am so pumped and excited to be doing this particular broadcast because this book is so fantastic. And I am going to turn to the first paragraph, if I can find it, of my review, because my 5 stars, by the way, are shining, people. This morning at 6 o'clock, I decided it was time to let them shine. This book is really cool, but my first paragraph is really great. The hardest part of writing a review is to come up with a first paragraph so that everybody wants to read it. So here we go. Lies. Everyone tells them. Don't say you never stretch the truth for your own personal gain to get information or hide an incident or something you'd rather people not know. Find out more because the author of The Last Scoop is here. Good morning, Dick.
Rich,
hi, Archie, how
hiya,
you doing?
Fran. Hi. Okay, good morning. We spent a lot of time recently. I think this is we've been on a couple of shows recently. It's great.
Yes, we have, and this is fun, and I'm so excited. This book is so fantastic. So
yeah, I'm glad you picked that line, by the way. You know, the lies thing, because that's in each of the books. So the books or the series is Claire Carlson, mm-hmm. a TV journalist, and in each book I do like a little opening chapter, which kind of mm-hmm. sets the tone, which isn't really about the plot of the story, but it's kind of about the tone that I want to set. And this one is about lies. And of course, as a journalist, Claire is always trying to get the truth.
Yeah.
But somebody in one of the reviews that somebody did, which I thought really was an interesting look at Claire, they said that, you know, she's totally about the truth and exposing lies, and yet she lies all the mm-hmm. time through the book, which she does, you know, and it's just
yeah,
different
know.
Kind of lies. So she'll lie and about herself. She lies to the reader about her personal stuff. She lies to people to get a story. But, you know, bottom line is she has this great sense of integrity and wants the truth, with a capital T, to sort of be out there.
Yeah, well, there are so many ways to tell a lie that you actually get away with it sometimes. Let me tell
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
What can I say? Then here's the last line of my book. Wait till you read my review. I hope you like it. The final ending will allow readers to learn whether Claire finally admits the biggest lie she ever told. Ha ha.
That's true.
I'm not
going to
tell you
true.
What that is. See,
that's true,
it.
That's
and
it's an ongoing. Obviously, it's an ongoing personal issue in her in the story. But I mean, the other thing that that opening chapter talks about with lies, which I think mm-hmm. is interesting, is because she at one point says, "Oh, I never lie," and you know, a lot of people say that I never lie, and the truth is, we all lie, and it's just a matter of degrees. You know, you know, you somebody says, what do you think of this outfit? And you go, oh, it looks really
mm-hmm.
nice, and you don't think it does, but you're lying, you know. Or you call in sick for work in the days when we used to go to work because you wanted to go somewhere, do something, you know. And then there's, you know, there's big lies, you know, there's lies that are damaging and things like that. And so that's the overall view of the book. But of course, the book is about something much bigger. The book is about a serial killer and corruption and a lot of other things, but truth is sort of the peg that I started off on.
Well, I read a book recently, I don't know why, but I didn't know, it was really interesting, called Golden State. And the book was about if you tell the truth, you get in trouble. You're supposed to lie. And throughout the whole book, you had to lie when the main character decided to tell the truth, he was exiled. So that's what, like, one of the stories that I wrote in my Faces book was, what if you tell the truth, you get exiled, you have to lie. And you're right, people lie about, oh, how do you look, how do you feel, and all the time. So,
and then you know, one lie, and then one lie will build on another, and that happens sometimes to Claire. Like, you might sort of do what you think is a small lie, and then that, and then you have to do another lie to cover up that lie. And then I also, the most historical classic reference to this, which I also talk about in the book, you know, was the line from Hitler, you know, which he used to boast to people, a big lie is easier to convince people of than a little lie. And, you know, that the bigger the lie, sometimes the easier it is to fool people, because they can't believe you would lie about such a massive thing. So again, this, you know, it's just so people understand. I mean, the book isn't like, this isn't the thrust of the book, but it's a kind of tone that goes through the book. The book's about murder and, you know, a lot more traditional things. Yeah.
The book is really good because I got eye strain reading it, because actually I just read it in one day. And
that's the way I like people to read it, because it's like I know, like, if I'm reading a book that I like, you want to go, it's kind of like binge watching something on TV, you know, you don't want to give breaks to it. So one of the best compliments I got for one of my books, somebody said once, is it reads like that Belsky, sat down and wrote it in one sitting without ever getting up, you know. And I thought, well, that's a really nice thing, because if that's the way, that's the way you want people to read it.
This is true. And I just got a book that I'm definitely not going to read because the font is smaller than my finger, I don't like self-help. I can't stand self-help. Ay, ay, ay.
And I just find with mysteries too, you know, and there's been a few over the years where if I'm not reading it straight through, writing, it's like, can I put it down and then I pick it up again, and I sort of forget what I read before, and then I kind of got to go back and check, and look, there's different kind of mysteries. There's mysteries that are not easy reading, that are very complex, and they can be really good. And what I try and do in my books, hopefully, and people seem to think I have in some occasions, is that they're complex. There's a lot going on in the plot, but I try and make it, you know, a good fast-paced read too, so that you're not bogged down, you know, like trying to figure it out. You're kind of reading and trying to figure it out as you go. And I guess, again, the best comparison would be like to a good TV show or a movie. You're watching a TV show and it's got, like, you know, it's got twists and things going on, but you don't have time to stop and think about it. You're just watching and moving forward.
This is true. I'd rather read a book, though, seriously. So
but the idea of movies is good, you know, like if you can get the kind of the pace of a good movie into a book, you know, I did an interview, I do a lot of interviews with authors. I did an interview with a while back with Lee Goldberg, who's does a lot of best-selling books now. But he used to be like a big TV executive, with a lot of shows, Monk, Diagnosis, Murder, and he wrote a terrific book called True Fiction, I think it was. He's written a couple since then, but
that.
And it starts off with this incredible bang, and it never stops. And I said, wow, you know, how did you do that? And he said, well, you know, I wrote it first as a script. And I said, oh, so you mean you were going to try and sell it as a movie? He said, no, it was always going to be a book. But he wrote it as a script, because he knew if he wrote it as a script, he could write it at a fast pace. And then he took the script and he turned that into a novel. And that's why the novel reads like a blockbuster movie, you know. And if you can pull that off, that's a good thing.
Well, he just wrote Fake Truth. I reviewed that one, too. That was interesting also.
Yeah, he's have you ever had him on the show?
I can't get him on a personal one interview. He was supposed to do one, and the publicist never gave him the time. He did one with Hollywood and the author, and how different authors got ripped off. He was really good, but I was hoping to get him on again, because that would be nice.
So he's one of the best interviews I think that I've ever done. You know, as being an interviewer.
I don't think I met him.
He's done because he's got a ton of stories about TV. He'll tell you, you know, he's got all these great stories from being in Hollywood and TV, and he's a really interesting.
That's what
guy,
we were talking about. It was interesting because it was him, Howard Shapiro, Lawrence Block, Tess Gunnison, and somebody else. It was really interesting. So we have to talk about the main character that put in Marty Bartlow. He comes to see Claire, and she sort of blows him off, and then he gets killed, and she feels bad.
Yeah.
So she's going to find out his why he came to her, and she's going to investigate the case.
So most of us, that's the beginning of the book. So most of us, or a lot of us anyway, if you've worked in a job somewhere, you have this kind of situation where you had you have somebody early on in your career who's like a mentor to you, who's great to you, and you owe him everything. And so Claire, when she had started out as a newspaper reporter years ago as a young kid, her boss at the paper was she was working at a paper in New Jersey, and her boss was this guy Marty Bartlow, and she always had this great affection for him and respect for him for everything he did, but he had been pushed out. He was retired now, and he was kind of like an angry old man, and he was like still trying to come up with news scoops and stuff, and she is the news director of a big TV station. And to be honest, she honestly just doesn't have time to deal with him. And so she wants to be nice, but she really can't listen to him with all his I've got a tip on something. And that's what happens. So he comes to her, and he tells her this tip about a story, and she's kind of half listening. And then a short time later, he winds up dead in a mugging, which presumably has nothing to do with it. But she suddenly starts wondering, well, you know, could it? But also more out of guilt. You know, it's like he came to her with this tip, so it was kind of like a memorial to him or whatever. She decides she's going to finish this story. So that's where the term the last scoop comes from. It's not her last scoop. It's Marty Bartlow's last scoop. And so she decides to go after this, not knowing what she'll find. And, of course, it kind of explodes into a huge – actually, two huge stories. So she starts going after one story about government corruption. And then it kind of morphs into a question of, like, about could there be a serial killer out there? And then she starts chasing after a serial killer. And at first she, like the reader, presumably is confused as to why there's two stories here. There's a corruption story and then there's a serial killer story. You know, as the book goes on, I think there is a logic to what the Bartlow character was doing, and so it's up to Claire to finish the story. So that was the idea that I started the book with, that a someone like Claire decides to try and finish a story as a kind of a memory to this person who was so helpful to her and who she really like felt guilty because she really didn't have time for at the end. Like there's a lot of people, you know, you don't have time for. You don't mean to, you like them, but you're just so busy and you're doing your life, and that's kind of what I wanted to do here. And Claire is basically a good person, and that was the motivation. And then of course once she gets into it, she realizes that it's not only a good story, but it's kind of like the story of a lifetime.
It is, and if she was had my mother on her case, she wouldn't have done that. Because my mother had this thing, if somebody needs your help in the family, tell them what you have to do. Just get them and get it done. Seriously. Ruthie's guilt all the time. So she goes after both stories. Now, this story really got me. The 8 buildings, what did she learn about them, and why didn't the police or anyone investigate the calls of the tenants? And to be very honest, this strikes a very personal chord. Because I won't say where I lived. I lived someplace else before I finally moved up here. And we used to complain about the elevators and the filth and the rats in the building and everything. And this was a pretty expensive building in the Bronx, too. So I can relate to this. Why didn't they answer it? How do these tenants, you know, these people, landlords, get away with that? And they do get away with it.
Well, you know, again, I don't want to give away too much in the book. But she basically begins to unweave a pattern of corruption. So all of these buildings are owned basically by the same real estate company, which is a kind of very shadowy real estate company, it turns out, and which may or may not have connections to all kinds of people, including people that, you know, Marty Beiler's father-in-law was possibly connected. You know, that's how you start into wondering. That's how he may have gotten the tip originally. But then you start getting connections to cover-ups by people in authority, maybe even reaching all the way up to DA's office. So that is the story. I mean, so what Claire is doing, the story isn't just that tenants aren't getting things fixed. Story is why, as you say, well, why isn't somebody doing it? So when the tenants call and complain, they're not getting any help. And the answer is because there's a pattern of corruption. So, like, you know, which is not unusual. I mean, I guess, and certainly in New York City, where people are being paid off to keep, you know, to look the other way, and these are in neighborhoods where you know, there's like one neighborhood where an elevator doesn't work and a little boy dies and things like that, because nobody listened to the complaints. But the real story is, the reason it's not they don't listen to the complaints because they don't care. They don't listen to the complaints because there's corruption involved, and that's what Claire starts out trying to root out. The question you just said, well, why aren't they? Why isn't something being done? But then, at some point in the book, the other shoe drops, and that's when it leads to this other story, which is about a serial killer. And a serial killer, the name of the serial killer I call the Wanderer, because this is not a serial killer like Son of Sam, who kills in New York City. This is a serial killer who travels around the country and has killed all over the country. The unique thing I think about my serial killer, as opposed to the thousands of other serial killers people have written about, is this is a serial killer no one even knows exists. I mean, it's not like Zodiac or Son of Sam or Ted Bundy. The point is, this person has been killing people all over the years, all around the country, and these crimes were never solved, and nobody ever linked them. So, like, if a woman is murdered on the beach in Florida, and another woman dies in a parking lot outside her job in Kansas City, nobody necessarily would ever link them. That's what Claire suddenly discovers, that, well, wait a minute, could there be a link between all these murders that have taken place in, you know, so it's a serial killer. The line on it is, he's the scariest kind of serial killer. He's the serial killer you don't even know exists until it's too late, so. And the name The Wanderer, for people who, you know, probably remember, certainly people of my age, The Wanderer is based on, you know, the famous song from the early 60s by Dion, you know, and the refrain is, you know, I roam around and around and around, look, you know, look for pretty girls, I roam around and around. And that's why the serial killer is called The Wanderer in my book.
Well, I like that title. That is good, and that is a My mother used to listen to that stuff, and she loved Dion and the Belmonts, and they live not too far from where we used to live on Southern Boulevard in Tremont.
That's right.
I grew up in the South Bronx. He didn't want to be there, trust me, but it was interesting. So the two guys that are behind part of the tenant thing are Vincent Morelli and Chad. So why are they involved, and how does that cause Claire to be in danger too? And
well,
then we're going to get to the other murder.
I don't want to get too much into the weeds on the plot. But Vincent Morelli, who pops up fairly early in the book, is a mob guy, and he's hovering around this, and you know, and Claire discovers that, and obviously that is linked to a lot of the corruption that, you know, that we referred to. And Chad is a guy, he's a very officious, annoying guy who works for the Manhattan DA's office. And rather than working with Claire to help uncover this stuff, Chad is like a roadblock. Like, he won't let Claire reach the DA, won't answer her questions. And so she becomes more and more suspicious of him and what his motivation is too. And he's a young guy on the way up, and he's got flashy clothes and all this. So there's a lot of and Claire takes an instant dislike to him. And when Claire takes a dislike to someone, there's generally a lot of insults, which there are. These are all part of this corruption scandal that she's involved in terms of the thing. And basically the first half of the book, or the first sections of the book, are about this corruption in New York City and her trying to uncover it. And at some point you start getting the first hints, but it takes a while, and then at some point that segues into the second part of the book, and which you referred to.
Yes, I did, and I'm going to refer even more people. Watch this. Mm-hmm. Well, you see, this is why I love Claire, because if I want to know something, like I did yesterday for whatever reason, I'm not going to stop until I get the answers I need to have.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how many times I have to make the phone call and stomp on people, I'm going to do it, which is important.
Yeah. Well, that's basic reporting. You know, that's something I learned.
Yeah.
You know, in real life, when I was at the New York Post and New York Daily News and places over the years,
mm-hmm.
and I was an editor, and one of the basic, and I use this concept with Claire and in a lot of my books over the years,
yeah.
Which is that reporters basically, they don't know exactly what they're going to find out. They just keep asking questions because
uh-huh.
you don't know where it's going to go, and you don't take no for an answer. My favorite story. I had a friend who was a really great reporter at the Post, and I told her once I actually used this story in one of my books. But the concept sort of works in all the books, and to me this symbolizes the kind of reporter that Claire is. So she was a young reporter, and she was trying to get a tryout at the Post. She'd come on as a young reporter, and she was super aggressive and super wanted to work and do anything to get the story. And there was an interview. There had been some kind of tragedy, and she needed. We were trying to reach the family of the victim, and the family wouldn't talk to anybody. And so she called the family, and the family hung up on her. And then she called again, and they just, they would just hang up. They wouldn't talk to her. And then at some point, she came over to my desk, and she said, "I got the interview." And I said, "With the family?" And she said, "I thought they wouldn't talk." She said, "Well, they didn't, but eventually they did." And I said, "Well, what happened?" And she's like, basically, "Well, I called them and they hung up. I called them a second time and they hung up. I called them a third time and they hung up. I called them a fourth time." And this went on and on and on until 13 calls. 13 times they hung up.
Oh, wow.
On the 14th call, they talked to her. And I was always, blown away by that, because I remember thinking, how many people would have gotten to that 14th call? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Most of us would have tried once, twice, three times. But she would not take no for an answer. And that basically is the kind of attitude, that Claire has, and I try and put. And people always say, when I write these books, they say, "Oh, is Claire based on anybody?" And the answer is yes. She's based on a lot of, really great women reporters
yeah.
that I've worked with over the years. Not one, and there's different elements, and there'll be a different story, and I remember that story. I'll have Claire do that. And that's the great thing about fiction, because you can put those all together into one person. In this case, that person is Claire Carlson. But I still know a lot of people kind of like Claire Carlson who live their lives like that, which is all about the big story. And, and they're great journalists, and their personal lives are not so great, because, their priorities are the story
mm-hmm.
and not taking care of their personal life.
Well, I agree, because yesterday I needed an answer to something. I won't say what. And the person that I was speaking to said, "Well, this person's going to call you back." I go, "No, it's going to be this person, because I'm not speaking to that person, because that person doesn't have the information and they were rude the first time." And I actually got the person to call me back to find out. So now we're going to find out. She and Claire uncovers another story that Marty was looking into, and that's the death of Becky. And how does that lead to the investigation of a link to her murder and the postal serial killer that's out there? This is so cool.
So I'm afraid, you know, people listening to this, they're gonna think it's more complicated. It's not really. When you're reading the book,
really,
I think it actually
easy.
Flows. Yeah, but so the reason she finds out about a serial killer is because she, for some reason, her mentor, when she goes through his old papers, he was also, in addition to the corruption, he was looking into a 30-year-old murder of a young girl in Indiana. And when she finds out that was his first newspaper job. He had been a young newspaperman in Indiana when this girl was murdered, and it had never been solved. And he wanted to go back in his old age and try and solve this cold case. And that's this girl called Becky. And now this in some ways was the beginning of the book for me when I sat down to write it, because this is actually based on inspired in part by a real life murder in my own when I was growing up. So I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, suburban Cleveland, Ohio, really nice, crime-free suburban neighborhood, you know, nothing happened bad, you know. And when I was, I think about, you know, a teenager, a young girl from a Catholic high school was brutally murdered in her bedroom in broad daylight inside her house. And the case was never solved. I mean, it was like, you know, one of the few murders I ever remember happening in my area, you know, and the case was never solved. And this was 50 some years ago, probably like, you know, 56, almost between 55 and 60 years ago. And you know, I've gone back and always been intrigued by it. And, you know, it's still one of those like cold cases that no one has ever solved. And of course, most of the people involved are gone now or dead. And, you know, so it probably never will be solved. And I was intrigued by this. And I had read a book by another author, interviewed him, who had done a book based on a murder he remembered from his teenage years too. And I was kind of thought, you know, that's just, I could do something off this. And so I did, obviously this is a fictionalized account of it. But I had my character, Martin Barlow, kind of obsessed with that because it had been the first murder he ever, you know, this case from his first newspaper job. And that gets Claire into the story. And from there, she begins to suspect that, maybe it wasn't just a random murder. Maybe it was the first of a series of serial killer murders. That's kind of from my own real life background, and it was kind of interesting. It's fun when you're writing fiction, when you have something like a story or a case that there is no ending for. It's fun to be able to make up, you know, like I always say, you know, it's like you can make up something up, and you can get some kind of closure, and you can kind of do anything you want in fiction, and that can be really satisfying.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's very interesting, but there are not a lot of people that can do what you do, and take it from this person that's read. My husband counted on my old computer plus my new one. I think I've read over 20,000 books in the last 10 years, maybe more. It scares me to think. Yeah, and some of them are good, and some of them are bad. And like I said, if a book isn't really, if it takes me more than a day to read the book, you're in trouble. No, I'm serious.
I won't even bother. When I read, you know, and I don't read obviously, you know, anywhere near what you read, but you know, I've been, you know, picking up some books, you know, like, you know, because we're all in our homes and apartments or whatever. And I always think about, you know, and I have to read some books that I don't particularly want to read, just like you probably do, because somebody has, you know, I have to interview somebody and I got to read the book, and sometimes they're good. You run into a lot of really interesting writers, and sometimes they're not so good, and you kind of got to plow through. Mm-hmm. And I'm always like fascinated when I finish a book. Yeah, like you put the book down, and sometimes you're like, oh, thank God that's over, you know. And then there's the other way. I mean, I just like picked a Michael Conley book off my shelf called Lost Light, mm-hmm. and went and read it again from beginning to end. And it was like you were saying, I mean, I basically read it, if not one sitting, but, you know, pretty close. It just never stopped. Mm-hmm. And when I was done, you know, I put the book down and I was like, wow, that was really great. And then I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, I got to find another Conley book and reread that, because, you know, and I think that's that's the goal that as an author that we want, which is that not only does the person want to read the book, but when they're finished reading it, you know, it's kind of like you go to a movie and you walk out of the movie and people say, a bad movie, and people say, well, I wish I had those 2 hours of my life back. Or you go like, wow, was that great? That was a great experience, you know. So that's kind of what you're hoping for as an author.
Well, I'm reading something right now. It's just that because of what happened to me, won't say what, that I'm taking my time because I have to be able to see what I'm doing. Kate White, Have You Seen Me? Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. Is that good?
It's interesting. Yeah,
okay.
This girl can't find what happened to herself. She goes to her old job, and her boss tells her she hasn't worked there in 5 years, but she doesn't know why she came there and what happened to her within 2 days. She's trying to find out. And I think I figured out who's gaslighting her. See, this is an easy one, but it's interesting. It's not bad at all, and I'm hoping to get an interview with her because I asked. I don't normally ask, but she's interesting. So, you know, the one thing I find fascinating that you could do that the rest of us can do is that you could reach out to law enforcement to help you. So she reaches out to law enforcement. Who helps her, and what about her boss? And how does he feel about the fact that Danny and Brett are taking a backseat and she wants to do the story herself on the air, which sometimes is good and sometimes is not so good?
Yeah, so this is the ongoing, and I think we've talked about this in my previous.
Yeah.
So this is my third Claire Carlson book. There's a fourth one coming out next year. And
good.
The one problem, one thing I have to work around, it's like when you write a book, there's certain things you don't think about. You just write, and then once the book comes out, you find with a series especially, you find yourself stuck in a situation. So when I wrote the first book in the series, Yesterday's News, it was originally never supposed to be a series. It was a standalone book about a woman who not only is working on a big story about a missing child, but who is in credit because she had won a Pulitzer for it. So she becomes incredibly personally involved in that story. Enough said, but you know from that book. So that was never meant to be a series. It was supposed to be just a standalone book. And then and she was the news director, and I had made her the news director, an executive now at a TV station. And so it made sense that she would cover the story herself because this was a story that had been so personally important to her. So that was all good. But then once the book was bought, the publisher said, oh, well, you know, you're going to write more of the character, right, because we love the character. And, you know, as an author, I'm like, sure. So that turned into a series about this TV news director. And the problem is, in each book, I have to figure out a reason why Claire Carlson, who's the news director, is out there reporting the story, because she should be sitting in an office going over budget sheets and rating reviews and things like that, ratings numbers and things like that. So, like, in this book, the peg is that that she's personally involved because her friend, her mentor, Martin Barlow, was the genesis of the story. So that's why she gets personally involved. But so in each book, you have to figure out a figure out a reason, because she shouldn't be, and she winds up getting in fights with her boss about this, who's the executive producer, because he's like, and I think, you know, in this book and most of the books, he's saying it a lot of times, like, hey, I need you as my news director. I don't need you, you know, running around the street. I need you here doing this job. But of course, she breaks big stories, which makes him look good. So it's this balance that you gotta walk on it.
That is very true. So she visits. See, I would do this. It's crazy to do it. She's interested in those 8 buildings, and she decides, you know, in order to get this right, she's going to go visit them, and that puts her in danger. So why is it that she's so impetuous and she often runs off at full speed? You know, I'm telling you, she's so like me, it scares me sometimes.
Well,
and she decides to just go off and find out. Yeah.
Well, part of that is, you know, a lot of that is fictional license, Fran. I mean, you know, like,
I know.
I mean, you know, I mean, sure, she could send a reporter to the buildings, but that wouldn't be very interesting as a book. You know, it's a lot better that she does it herself. And it's not a multi-viewpoint book. It's all written from her viewpoint. So her sitting in an office getting a report is not as interesting. I mean, one of the funny things about my books, because I work so long in newsrooms, and I obviously it's something I know a lot about how a newsroom works. And one of the things people always say in reviews or whatever, they'll be like, "Wow, this is a really authentic version of how a newsroom works. This is the way it really happens," you know. And the truth is, that's not true at all. I mean, it isn't. This is not the way the newsroom works. A news director is not, as you point out, she's not going to go to buildings herself, knock on doors, get herself picked up by mobsters, you know, get in conflicts like that with people. But you know, when you're writing the book, you want to make it, if you wrote the book just about how it really was, it would be a pretty dull book. So, you know, and it's just, and I probably have told this story. It's my favorite, one of my favorite stories, is the, you know, the Raymond Chandler story, you know, and I always think about that when I'm doing this. And when Raymond Chandler was writing Philip Marlowe books, and some critic basically ripped him and said that they're really unrealistic, that Philip Marlowe is not a real private eye. Like, a real private eye doesn't do a real private eye does not, you know, get hit over the head every time he walks into a room. He doesn't meet a beautiful blonde client. I mean, he said, you know, real private, this is not very realistic of what a private eye does. And Chandler's response was, "You're absolutely right, it's not. But if I wrote about what a real private eye did, absolutely nobody would read my books," you know. And I think that's what we do as fiction writers. You know, if you're a journalist, there's a lot of days you go to the office, you have real boring days, you know. You just sit there and you do some boring stuff. But, I mean, nobody wants to read that. So you write it in a way that is certainly a lot more dramatic than, you know, in real life, nobody could do a lot of the things that Claire Carlson does. But then in real life, you know, nobody could do the things like that Michael Connelly's Harry Bosch does either. You know, or Kinsey Malone and, you know, any of the characters. Mm-hmm. So that's what makes it fun writing fiction.
So before I forget, because I forgot to do this last week, oh well, too bad, except as I remembered, on Thursday, Diver's Paradise, Davin Goodwin.
So Davin is he's a friend of mine. Very good book, by the way.
I know. I think it was your fault that I got it, because I think I saw you post something on Facebook, and I said, I want that.
Yeah,
and
it's, yeah.
I have a bad habit of doing that, which is good. Reese Hirsch, The Dark Tomorrow on the 12th. On the 14th, I'm going to try something different. Minister Sam Oliver and I are going to talk about soul caring and healing care. And on the 19th, a very close friend of mine, Pastor Michael Jones, and I are going to talk about stress and how the pandemic, how you can uplift yourself in a time of stress and pandemic. On the 21st, the King of Horror, I love him, Brian Morland, Tomb of the Gods. On the 26th, someone we all know and love who picked up the Jessica Fletcher series and Murder of 12, John Land. And on the 28th, nothing like ending it with, how do you pick your killer and how does he decide to kill someone, with R.G. Belsky, Charles Salzberg, Tom Walsh, and Bruce Coffin. And that's just May. I just finished booking for June. And
then I'm back in June. I'm back in June again, right, with the Dana Perry.
I hope
book,
I get so. The book soon, yeah. I still
yeah,
didn't get
no,
it,
I haven't
but
gotten
we'll
it either
to...
yet. So it's yeah, that's a it's an online book. But so anyway, I mean, just to, so everybody is aware. So today is actually the publication date for The Last Scoop. So it literally hit the thing today, and it's, you know, look, it's weird because I was supposed to have a book party tonight, which obviously I'm not having, and things like
that. Yeah, I know.
Everything going on, and it's you know, and pretty much all the bookstores are closed in terms of physically walking in. But you know, it's available everywhere. You know, it's you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can order online from, you know, everywhere. Apple, a lot of local bookstores are still, you know, filling orders online. So it's just, it's a different world. But, you know, today is the pub date. So, you know, anybody's interested, this is, you know, it's not hard to get it. And if nothing else, you go on my website, www.rgbelsky.com, you'll see all the options for buying it.
Well, you should get it because, after all, you have to stay home and read, and you want to read something that's not going to put you to sleep. That's really good. That's just unbiased opinion. So,
one thing that was interesting, and I think we talked about this on another show, Fran, with Marcia, you know, which is, you know, are people reading more now than before? And I would think yes, because you're home, and even though you can't go to a bookstore, you know, it's so, you know, I know you don't read online, but everybody has a lot of books in the house. A lot of people are ordering books on Kindle to read. So it's just interesting.
The library does it too, because my husband has an iPad, and he looked at me. He says, "You're so jealous because you have the book." I said, "Pick up the phone, pick up your computer, whatever, and order it on Amazon. They'll send it. Don't worry about it." But he reads on his iPad, and he does order stuff from the library. You can order any bestseller or anything from the library too, and download it. In my case, if I have to do an interview, I gotta have the book in front of me so I could destroy it. This is the truth. And that's just the way it is. So we have another character that I found interesting. I'm not going to say why. Michelle, why does she give Claire access to Marty's documents? And tell us about Thomas, her father. He's not a nice guy.
Yeah. So she's the granddaughter of so when Claire starts looking into Martin Barlow's death, the first place she goes into his family. Now, he had been his wife had died, and he had been retired and living with his daughter. And his daughter is a kind of like weirdly unemotional, unfeeling. She's not bad. She's just kind of not there. And her husband is this kind of high-powered real estate salesman, who may or may not be connected with the corruption in these buildings. And so Claire, when she goes to visit him, is kind of turned off by the can't believe that Marty, this guy that was such an interesting guy, that his daughter is so like just not connecting to anything, and that she's married to this guy that, you know, that seems like a real operator. But there's a granddaughter, and apparently Marty had been very close to the granddaughter, and. So Claire also becomes closer to her, and she goes to her for help, and the granddaughter actually helps Claire access some of Marty's old records because a lot of his stuff on the serial killer had been in like a password protected file that she had set up from the granddaughter because he didn't really know how to do a lot of that stuff. So the only person in the family that she really like finds interesting and sympathetic is the granddaughter. And, you know, she even wonders at one point, like, well, how did Marty have a daughter that's kind of so unlike him? And then he has a granddaughter that is like this real person. It's almost like all his good points skipped a generation or something, you know. And I think we've all had those feelings about people. You're like, man, is that really that person's kid? Because that person isn't anything at all like their parents, you know, or something like that. And that's what she finds out about Marty's family. But, she forms a pretty close connection with the granddaughter, and that leads to a lot of other stuff, which, I can't really get into all of it, but the granddaughter plays a role, certainly, in helping Claire access a lot of the stuff, and also to find out what Marty was thinking about, because the granddaughter was the only person that that Marty kind of opened up to, because he wasn't really relating to his own daughter and things like that. So she's an interesting character in the book too. And,
okay, now here's the other one that's interesting. She got in trouble with him the first time. She really has this thing for Scott Manning, which is not
good.
Yeah,
so...
And she reaches out to him.
This is another issue you have when you have a... There's a lot of issues when you have a series that you don't have, when you have a standalone. And one of them is the romance. So Claire sleeps around a bit. I mean, she's been married three times.
Good for her,
some romances. So she's... But so I've had, you know, in the first couple books, there's been romances. But in the second book, she met this guy, Scott Manning, who she really kind of fell for, and he was really interested in her, and she winds up, and he's a cop, and he's a cop that's involved in the story in the previous book, and everything is great except for the fact that he happens to be married, and he had been sort of separated from his wife, but then he goes back to his wife because for the sake of their kids, and so that kind of puts the kibosh on that romance in the second book. So in this book, she really doesn't want to relate to him anymore because it's too painful. But it turns out he's not working for the FBI, and his job is working involving, like, profiles on serial killers and stuff. So she needs to go to him as a source, and she makes it clear to him, and he makes it clear to her that it has to be, you know, this is totally professional. It's nothing about our past. We're just dealing on a professional level. And, you know, if you know Claire, you're going to be pretty aware that that promise won't last. And so they do wind up getting entangled on a personal level as well. And he plays a big role in this book too. But yeah, so when you have a series character like this, the dilemma you always have is, does the person have a romance each book with somebody new, or do they have a partner that they're with all the time? And you know, I always find it more interesting when they're not. I mean, I always thought one of the and I loved all the Spencer books, the 40 some books that Robert Parker did, but I always like hated a lot of the scenes with him and his girlfriend Susan Silverman, or his woman friend Susan Silverman. They just got boring, you know, like, and to me it's more interesting. You know, I sort of grow up on the, you know, like, I remember the old Rockford Files. Every episode, Rockford would have some romantic interest with someone, or most of them. And then the next episode, that person would be gone, and then he'd have a romantic interest with somebody else. You know?
I know.
And it's like, it goes all the way back to Cheers. I mean, with Ted Danson and you know, Sam and Shelley or Diane, Sam and Diane, you know.
Yeah.
And with Shelley Long, and they, for a couple of years, they had this on and off romance, and people loved it. And then, you know, once they actually hook up, it became less interesting. And so that's always the dilemma. So that hasn't happened to Claire yet. And so she has this on and off romance with this married guy, Scott Manning. And he plays, he plays a big, big part in this book because she is working with him hand in hand to catch the serial killer. But, you know, as she's working with him, there's temptations, and they wind up spending a lot of time together, and they're on the road. And so he's, you know, and he's away from his wife, and let's just say, you know, things happen.
I know. She's so bad. I wouldn't trust her in the room with anybody. To be very honest, seriously. So, she gets into the FBI's investigation, and then someone leaks her story. So what does she do? And she finally puts it together.
This,
we won't say how. Yeah, she's good,
this
but
is a,
God help you
this
with
is,
her.
Yeah, this is a dilemma. This is like a journalist. You know, I try not to dwell too much on the journalism stuff because it's really a crime novel, but this is like a real journalistic issue, which is, once she determines that there is a serial killer out there, she has two choices. I mean, one of which is the obvious one. She can go on the air and report, oh, we've discovered there's a serial killer. But the other option is she can work with the FBI. And the idea that if she's on the inside of the FBI, they'll give her an inside look at everything they're doing so that when she breaks the story, it will be like an incredible inside story as opposed to just, oh, there's this happening. So she is like negotiating with the FBI of this idea, like, well, I'll sit on the story if you do this for me. And, you know, there's some questions about this. Her boss is uncertain, but she argues that she can trust them because of Scott Manning. And then while this is happening at some point in the book, someone else in the media finds out about the story, and so she gets beat on her own story. And that's like the ultimate, you know, horror for any journalist, which is you have the story, you sit on it too long because you're trying to make it better, and somebody else breaks the story. And then no matter what you do, you're like second with it. And I've seen variations of that, you know, in my journalism career, and so that's kind of what I wanted to portray here. And you know, there's no right or wrong answer. It's just like you can do the story now, but it's going to be kind of like a not, you know, just a superficial story. Or you can sit on a story and work with us, and we'll give you an even much better story. And, you know, but the downside is somebody else could break the original story before you do. And that's the dilemma that that Claire finds herself in here.
I know. That makes it really bad because you work really hard and you want the scoop. And I'm sure it happens in real life. I mean, I listen to all of the supposedly press conferences and updates and stuff, and I watch the reporters asking questions. And it's funny because I could tell who the person wants to ask, ask the question, and who, when the person asks the question, they just say, I'm not going to say that anything, I can't talk about it. You can tell right away which reporters are favored and which are not. So who is Russell Danziger? And he's not a nice person. I don't like him.
Yeah, there's a lot of not nice people in my book.
I didn't like him at all. Sorry.
Because that makes it interesting. So Russell Danziger is a political power broker, and mm-hmm. you know, we've seen he's one of these behind the scenes guys who has a lot of money and a lot of power, and kind of is he's not a politician himself, but he's a political kind of kingmaker, and he's behind a political campaign in this, and he may at some point, and you know, this comes on fairly early, so it's not really a spoiler. At some point, Claire begins to suspect that not only is he not a nice guy and that he's very power hungry, but that he might be the serial killer. So she begins to think that that this Russell Danziger could be the Wanderer, so he goes to the top of her list of suspects, and a great deal of the book is her kind of like trying to tear away this. He's one of these people that no one really knows about, or nobody, because he doesn't really give interviews or anything. He's just kind of like a power behind the scenes. And she's really determined to find out not only the truth about him, but could he actually be some guy who his need for power goes into actually murdering people. So there will be a number of suspects for the serial killer because it's a murder mystery, but he's one of her prime suspects as she's looking into it.
Well, she gets the real facts, but the last line of the book tells me that you're going to bring something from the past back. Are you bringing that back in the next one? Without saying what it is.
Yeah, right. So there's a
that was so interesting. Go on. Whoa.
Well, then I was trying to remember what the last line was, but I know what the topic was. The next book will be out in 2021. It's called Beyond the Headlines, which is a year away yet, and that'll be the fourth book. And I just finished writing that, which is why I had to think what the line in the third one was. But as you know, there's an ongoing arc in these books involving Claire's personal life, and because so much of it is the basis for the plot of the first book. I don't want to get into the specifics because
that's why.
I think if somebody were to go back and read yesterday's news, but she has personal issues that and one of them is so overwhelming that it goes through all the books, you know, and it's left not necessarily resolved after the first book, and then it continues in the second one, and it continues in this one, and yes, that is the ending of the third book. And again, it's not like I'm leaving open the plot. I always like pretty much solve the plot in the book. But this is her life is never solved as easily, and it can't be. And in every book, you find out a little bit more about the personal issues she's dealing with, and that will continue on in the fourth book when it comes out a year from now. But I don't think it necessarily. I mean, you can read the plot of the murder without. You know, her personal thing is kind of like it's like a B story going on behind the scenes while she's doing the other thing.
Well, I'm glad you're bringing that back. So, before we end, who else are you bringing back?
Oh, the big one, and you haven't mentioned her, is because everybody needs a confidant, and Claire's confidant
Janet.
Janet. So Janet is like everything
right.
that Claire. Janet is this lawyer who's everything that Claire isn't. I mean, she's like together. She's got a happy family life. She's like organized. And so, but she and Claire are like best friends. And Claire uses her to, you know, run stuff by, and when she needs like a sanity check. And then the newsroom, because, you know, I have a lot of fun running the newsroom. I've got an executive producer who's named Jack Farron, who's like one of these kind of beleaguered guys, you know, and, you know, sort of like an Ed Asner, Lou Grant type guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like a decent guy, but kind of like under the gun all the time. And then I've got a couple anchors, and called Brett and Danny, and they're interesting because not only are they co-anchors on the air, but they wind up having a romance in an earlier book, and so they're, you know, and Brett leaves his wife for his co-anchor, and so you got that. And then I have Claire has an assistant named Maggie, who's like a real smart, you know, young woman who's like kind of, again, kind of keeps Claire on track, because, you know, Claire is so wacky, crazy sometimes that it's good to have people like Maggie and Janet. And then I have a few of the typical TV people who are, like, hired for their looks as opposed to necessarily their intellect or reporting skills. And Claire has to deal with that and gets frustrated by the fact, like, as she points out, there's people that don't really know much, but they get good ratings. And some of those people on the air probably make more money than she does because, you know, they're the glamour kind of thing. And so, and Claire is like never comfortable on TV. She's a newspaper person, and she's never really comfortable with all the rules of TV, but that's the world she's in. And that kind of struggle, I think, kind of makes it interesting too, because she complains a lot about TV, but it's her job, and that's what she does.
Yeah, well, I noticed that too when I'm looking at the news now. None of those people look like they're wanting for hair and makeup. They're all dressed in perfectly, you know, roots are done and everything. And I'm saying that this is just not fair. They do.
Yes.
Most of the people that I'm noticing on Channel 12 are all young and all, you know, glamorous. I mean, it's not that they're not good at reporting, but they are. A lot of people listen to them because of it. Whereas Channel 4 has, you know, Hoda Kotb and Savannah and them also, and they always look like they're ready to go to a party too.
Yeah.
So I guess it's an appearance has to be. So before we end, one more: where can we learn more about you and your work, and where can everybody get tonight? Listen, people, Mother's Day is Sunday, and Father's Day is coming up. And in case you have company or you have a family, well, you don't know what to get the person, books are good. That's my favorite present, by the way, books and more books.
And everybody is selling, you know, the point is that so many bookstores I've seen are you know, they're filling orders and mailing books, and it's actually good to support them. Yeah, I think the best place is to go to my website, www.rgbelsky.com. But like I said, the book's everywhere. You find it on Amazon. The Last Scoop is by me, R.G. Belsky. But I'm also on Facebook as R.G. Belsky. And, you know, if you Google me, you'll find me a lot of places. You know, I'm Dick Belsky as a journalist, but I'm R.G. Belsky as an author. It's the same guy. So if you find stuff under another name, it's the same person. But yeah, I'd like, somebody actually wrote a review in which they said they thought this Claire book was the best one of all the three, and I was really pleased with that, because I really enjoyed writing this one, and I think it's I know I'm biased, but I think it's interesting and a good read. So
I think I wrote that too somewhere in my
good
review.
I wrote a
very nice one. It took me, you know, actually the truth, I'll give away a little bit of a secret, not really. I read the book and then I stop reading after a half an hour. Then I take out my notepad on my phone and I write what I want to write. Then I read more, and then I write what I want to write. By the time I got the book done, the review's on my phone, so that when I post it to my computer, it doesn't disappear. No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
My computer's
very selective.
Well,
I haven't actually read your reviews. I have not actually had a chance to read your review yet, so I'll look.
Uh-oh. Now I'm in big trouble. I don't know. I think I wrote something.
I'm sure you won't be too
cool.
It's unique.
I'll tell you that.
All right.
Anyway, Dick, thank you so much. This is like,
thank you, friend.
Yeah, Cheryl just said she's going to be getting the book. If she didn't get it, she wants it. And this is great. Yeah. And I'm so excited, and you're coming on next month, and I just put it on Facebook. I am looking for people that actually are brave enough to do this thing on social distancing and wearing a mask. And after my personal experience, I'd be interested to know what other people think. But everybody, it's a beautiful day outside. Those of you that like to walk, go slowly. Walk carefully. Watch where you're going. But thank you so much. Everybody have a great day. And
thank
bye.
You, friend, as always. Bye-bye.